And we continue with the ensuing question and answer session. The first question was off mic, but he asked about Marx's ideas about work, only he used the word job.
There's one word I didn't use. The word job. I talked about work. We have already, under this technological development, got into a way of thinking that work can be got only when you have a job. A job which means an employer. We talk about unemployment. And we even have the most absurd word in this thing, namely that someone who does his own thing is called self-employed. I think the time where one looks simply for jobs provided by corporations, etc., big organizations, that time is also coming to a close. And what Ivan Illich calls the self-support system will have to be developed quite consciously. Let me enlarge on this for just a moment. We live on two systems. This is Ivan Illich. On the one hand, what he calls the self-support system, that which we do for ourselves. What we do in the home or in the narrowest circle of community. And the other system is the market system, that we get other, which we get other people to do for us against money, or possibly barter occasionally. Now what has happened is that during the last 50 years the self-care, self-support system has virtually collapsed. There's very, very little. I mean, take the medical field. In my youth, and I did survive my youth, 95% of all ailments in the family were looked after by that excellent medical auxiliary mum. A very simple means, you see. And we only went to the doctor in very rare cases. Mainly, it was a self-support system. And there was the knowledge of how to deal with all these little things. This has ceased, certainly in this country and many other countries that I know. This is finished. The self-support system has disappeared, and for every little thing, one goes to the doctor. I read some statistics. The doctor now in Britain has about 3.5 minutes per patient. In Germany, only 2 minutes, because they, of course, are a far more efficient society than Britain. So, we are not talking only about jobs, we are talking precisely about work. Namely, that the human being is created to, first of all, externalize and make something of the potential laid into him or her. If that is frustrated, he or she becomes deeply unhappy and probably very destructive. This is the chance we're given by life, which, as the Buddhists say, is a benefit hard to obtain. Secondly, we are put into this world with a great deal of egocentricity, which is necessary because we have, first of all, to survive. But our task is to overcome this egocentricity. And this we can only do by working with others. Not by playing football with others. I mean, look at it. What happens there, really? No, by being engaged in creative, useful work jointly with others. This helps us to overcome this egocentricity. And thirdly, work is there to provide the wherewithal for living. But that's only the third of them. Now, we have to reconsider all jobs. Do they satisfy these three requirements? Well, we haven't done this for 100 years. We have set only the third requirement, that it is productive. But the productivity is collapsing now, because people are so completely fed up. in most cases, with their work, that they only give one third of what they could give. And it's no use preaching to them. One has to change it so that the work is humanized. Of course, there are these dreamers, and I won't use any worse words, who say, don't bother to humanize work, we're going to abolish it by automation. But when you look at it, they're abolishing the last remainder of intelligent and interesting work, and leaving all this interesting work to automated machinery, and using the human being exclusively as what a German philosopher Nietzsche called the gap filler, where human ingenuity can't quite cope. Now, of course, it's very much easier to do productive processes in a machine than feeding in material and taking away the output. To mechanize that is very difficult. So all the most stupid and mindless work then remains to be done by people. Or even a worse kind of thing, which is not even stupid, because then you don't need your intelligence. No continuous dial watching or computer programming, you know, where only a very humdrum and low human capacity is being used, but that is used all the time. Logic actually is one of the minor human capacities. It doesn't require a lot of development. Any of you who have watched small children, you know that this is the first phase. It's the smallest children who are the most logical. Most of the time we don't realize it because they're not sufficiently articulate. But if this reminiscence is permitted, Mr. Chairman, I never forget, I used to get up very early in the morning and tiptoe downstairs to have a little bit of time for myself. But the staircase creaks, and I had a young son, aged 4, and sometimes he heard me, and I just settled down, the door is flung open, in he comes, he rolls over the furniture. And I said, Robert, I actually had come here to have a bit of peace and quiet. And he looked at me with astonishment and said, does Mummy make so much noise in bed? You can't beat the logic of that. Well, forgive me, that's what I mean about work.
Dr. Schumacher, you mentioned revolution, political change. But since it would seem obvious that the bigger you make government, the more trouble you create, what structure do you envision as the best to try to bring out a homeless?
I didn't get the end of the sentence. What do I envision?
What structure do you envision as the best to try to bring out the homeless?
Well, as I said, I'm only interested in finding points where I can apply my own little lever and do something. So I have no blueprint for a political structure which I couldn't implement anyhow. What I think all of us are already doing is to create new, relatively more self-contained structures, which very often succeed in bypassing big government. Or doing one very satisfactory thing, bypassing the tax system. If you do things for yourself, the self-support system doesn't attract taxation, which is one of its beauties. So we can't, a frontal attack never leads to anything, except shouting and a hardening of the arteries on both sides. We can circumvent it. But this is not so easy, so a lot of experimentation is necessary. Well, here is a place of this kind of experimentation, a community where a lot is done on the spot, which bypasses a lot of structures,
A lot of taxes.
That's right. A lot of taxes. Also, it has tucked itself away in a remote corner where the chaps of Whitehall don't often venture to go. It's that sort of thing. If we had here an assembly of the world's prime ministers, one would talk in other terms, more theoretical terms. But two prime ministers of very important countries have said to me in the same words, look, I am only a prime minister. I can't do anything except what the system serves up to me. So even there, the thing is, it's almost stalled. I used to have a recurrent dream after I joined the National Coal Board, which was a huge organization. I dreamt that we were at a board meeting and had a very heavy going discussion with all these worried men there. And finally it was decided to take some action. And in my dream there was a big wall with a panel with all sorts of levers. And it was decided we need to reduce absenteeism, let's say. And somebody would then get up and operate the lever, absenteeism, and then sit down, rather exhausted. And they said, well, now, we've done something. In my dream, I was able to look behind the panel and found it wasn't connected with anything at all. At the next meeting, you see, a report was made, and has absenteeism actually gone down? And one of three answers was possible. No, it has gone up. And then everybody would say, yes, circumstances are against us. Or it has gone down, they would say, well, our policy has been successful. Or it has not moved at all, and they would say, it's early days yet. So let's forget about big government. It's one of the dinosaurs. Other people who are inside, they may be able to do something from the inside. Let us create new structures which have a much higher degree of independence.
Dr. Schumacher, you were very clear with the point that we must first think about the situation in which we find ourselves. Would you comment on the proposition that even before thinking about the situation that we need to feel about it, to learn to feel about it?
Well, everything needs a motivation. If you don't feel anything, you won't even think, will you? So I agree with you.
The gentleman with his $100,000 patterning machine, and ultimately suggested to him that perhaps he should concentrate on upgrading the stage one equipment. And I wonder if that doesn't just begin the process over again, and in the event that perhaps the gentleman did begin to upgrade stage one equipment, how does one call a halt to it? How does one find the middle?
Why are you worried about it? Why don't you take a situation? There are hundreds of millions of people who need help. They're crying out for help. And even in a country like India, where there's so much need, the intellectuals, educated at the expense of society, they go to the periphery of technology, the rich man's technology. So the people are left without any help whatsoever. Now, why can't we help them? Why should we worry whether the help, perhaps in later generations, will lead to wrong developments? Good gracious me. I mean, this is Tolstoy. As you will... We'll do anything except get off their backs. The Chinese worked out that it takes the work of 30 peasants to keep one person at university. So if that person has been at university for 5 years, he or she have consumed 150 peasant work years. Well, there was the late Mao Zedong, who said, young person, what do the peasants get back from this? If you go into a comfortable district in Shanghai to live it up with other privileged people, they get back nothing. No, you go into this remote village and help the peasants with your marvelous knowledge. And then the students went there. And they found that what they had learned at university was of no use at all. That if they were doctors, they couldn't help a woman who was giving birth to a child, because they had been trained to be able to do this only surrounded by 5,000 pounds worth of equipment. The local midwife could do it, but she didn't do it very well. So the obvious thing, and this has happened in China, is the students came back and said, hey, what we are learning has no real relevance to real life. We want to learn something that we can go into the village and not make fools of ourselves. So they upgraded the midwife's technology. And I didn't worry their heads whether in the year 2500, perhaps some crazy new fangled medicine will develop. Now they actually helped people. 90% of all freight in India is moved by bullock cart. Well, do the intellectuals, the highly trained engineers, etc., pay some attention to the bullock cart? Not on your life. They're interested in supersonic transport and other little jokes like that. All we are saying is, couldn't we find it in our heart to give a bit of this intelligence to the improvement of the bullock cart? Where, of course, you can have improvements which now really would help the people to improve the efficiency of this by a factor of 5 or 10, by quite simple means. But it's not happening. I studied all these industries in Asia, and the poor are in many cases using equipment that was antiquated at the time of the Buddha. Nothing had happened. Because of this disease that had infected society, still infecting us, that those who have the immense privilege of education will not use the fruits of education to help the poor, but only to make complications for the rich more and more profuse. That's what we're talking about.
Dr. Schumacher, this seems to me a great dilemma. Is it possible to do a job, and I know you regard this as a dirty word, is it possible to do a job for which one is paid by a large organization in order to try to live creatively, despite that job? And this does seem to me a very great dilemma which faces many millions of people. I'd be most grateful for an answer off of that.
You mustn't say such things as if I consider the word job a dirty word. I don't. I'm simply saying it doesn't cover the subject. The real subject is work. And I do say that we should not get it in our minds that the only chance we have to do work is if we're working for an employer and have a job. That's all I mean. Yes, we are always, and are bound to be, this is part of the education of life, in certain situations of a degree of compulsion. Life has not been arranged, and don't blame it on me, but it has not been arranged so that we can always pick and choose the ideal thing. So we are most likely, for certain parts of our lives, we're going to be, or in my case have been, in situations where we have to do a job that isn't precisely what we want, and there are many things that we don't even really approve of, etc. It's an excellent learning situation. And the art of it is to utilize this as well as one can, for one's own a real understanding and development. There's always something to be learned. There's a lot to be learned from the difficulties, more from the difficulties than from the ease of life. So here again, if this is really a bad situation, and one really feels this is a waste of time, one's task is to make it still a fruitful situation. And then perhaps prepare very quietly some alternative. I think that, well, of course, the first thing one would have to do is to gain a little bit of free time. If one goes out to do that, one finds one has bags and bags of time to do at least two jobs. And the easiest way to gain a lot of time is to abolish the television. People come to me and say, well, I haven't got time, and when I look into it, I find they're spending about 4 or 5 hours a day looking at the ogle box. That's just the first thing, you see, get these things sorted out in one's mind. And then one finds there is plenty of time. I mean, work it out. There are 168 hours in the week. And only 40 hours, the 40-hour week, you know. So what do you do with the other 128 hours? That's the question. That's plenty of time. So you can always write the real thing on the back of the job you have to do. This is perfectly honorable. The 40 hours belong to the employer. Of course, if you are asked to do dirty things, then you say, I'd rather starve than do that. But normally, you're not asked to do dirty things, you're simply asked to do silly things. Well, one can put up with that, you know. In other words, let's have a relaxed attitude about these things, but a conscious attitude. That we know exactly that this is not the right job, but we don't indulge in the luxury of suffering from that. You say, no, therefore, I have now to utilize this. Because the living, if the job is your living, that's not to be sneezed at.
You talk of returning to old. Do you see that in the cyclic sense, or in an evolutionary unfolding sense? Do you
return to what?
You talk of the return to the sense of wholeness, to the sense of a forefather's. Do you see that as a cyclic process, or evolutionary process?
Well, one might just as well end such a session with a bang rather than a whimper. The greatest destructive force in Western civilization has been the abuse of the word evolution. If we could have just a couple of years where we will not use the word, we might recover from this terrible disease. What do we mean by evolution? There are certain facts which are not controversial, namely that living substances have a certain facility of adapting to changing circumstances. Out of this interesting and fascinating discovery, modern man, who had only one desire to get rid of the Almighty, has made a theory that everything has just come by itself, from chance and necessity, which the 19th century accepted with tremendous relish, because it meant getting rid of the headmaster, and you could then do what you liked. And the 20th century made an even greater error. They thought this was science. But it has nothing to do with science. It's just a completely absurd, in fact, schizophrenic interpretation of the evidence. It is true that there is this power of adaptation, this adaptability. But there is absolutely no evidence of any kind that suddenly something emerges out of nothing. If in fact, you know, Mozart or Shakespeare is an accidental collocation of atoms, then anything is possible. Then, then it is quite stupid for us to teach our children that 2 and 2 is 4, because why shouldn't it be 400? If something comes out of nothing, without any creation behind it. So, I come back to this. This is not an evolutionary thing. It's got nothing to do with evolution. It's taking the wrong road. It is deserting the truth. That is what happened to Western civilization. It's the great Western deviation. So we have to find our way back to truth. There's no cycle about it. There's no evolution about it. This is all nonsense. The point is that we have to realize we have fallen and we have to get up again. And let's send all the professors home and make them do something useful. If possible, on stage 1 technology. And stop befogging our minds with these far-fetched notions, these absurdities, as if something simply arises out of nothing, as if there was some evolutionary process that took care of what are our jobs to do, as if there was a new generation that was suddenly endowed by evolution with things that had never existed before, and all this stuff. No, let's be humble shoemakers. Get the best leather we can find and make the best shoes we can find.
Now, I confess, for a fleeting moment, I did consider removing that last question to give us more room for John Taylor Gatto interview, but the more I reflected on it, the more I thought, no, that's not being true to Schumacher. I'm not presenting an accurate picture of the talk he gave. And the more I thought, actually, I think he's got a really good point. I know it's an angle that is close to Gatto's heart. It's not one he dwells on in his presentations. But the thought of getting rid of the schoolmaster, of saying, well, there is no purpose to any of this, this is random collocations of atoms, and if you look for one, if you can try and understand one, you're wasting your time. That, you didn't think I was going to go a whole show without mentioning the money system, did you? That is the premise of modern economics, which is psychopathic in its nature. It says, well, no, everybody is out for themselves, and no one has any valuable relationships with anything. In fact, there is no value of any kind except what can be measured by money. I think the utter bankruptcy of that position will be made clear to humanity pretty soon, and I think Schumacher was well ahead of his time in anticipating it. I think that denial of meaning, that denial of the wholeness of life, the unity of humans, the unity of all living beings on the planet, I think that is really at the root of it. So, now let's move from one Catholic to another. This is Ivan Illich. We're going to have chapter 5 of Deschooling Society on the shallowness of much of the debate about school reform, perhaps all of it, in the early 1970s. Well, I think if it was true then, it's at least equally true now. So let's hear Ivan Illich for an alternative take. Chapter 5. Irrational Consistencies. I believe that the contemporary crisis of education demands that we review the very idea of publicly prescribed learning rather than the methods used in its enforcement. The dropout rate, especially of junior high school students and elementary class teachers, points to a grassroots demand for a completely fresh look. The classroom practitioner, who considers himself a liberal teacher, is increasingly attacked from all sides. The free school movement, confusing discipline with indoctrination, has painted him in the role of a destructive authoritarian. The educational technologist consistently demonstrates the teacher's inferiority at measuring and modifying behavior, and the school administration, for which he works forces him to bow to both Summerhill and Skinner, making it obvious that compulsory learning cannot be a liberal enterprise. No wonder that the desertion rate of teachers is overtaking that of their students. America's commitment to the compulsory education of its young now reveals itself to be as futile as the pretended American commitment to the compulsory democratization of the Vietnamese. Conventional schools obviously cannot do it. The free school movement entices unconventional educators, but ultimately does so in support of the conventional ideology of schooling. And the promises of educational technologists that their research and development, if adequately funded, can offer some kind of final solution to the resistance of youth to compulsory learning sound as confident and prove as fatuous as the analogous promises made by the military technologists. The criticism directed at the American school system by the behaviorists, and that coming from the new breed of radical educators, seem radically opposed. Behaviorists apply educational research to the induction of autotelic instruction through individualized learning packages. Their style clashes with the non-directive co-option of youth into liberated communes established under the supervision of adults. Yet, in the historical perspective, these two are just contemporary manifestations of the seemingly contradictory, yet really complementary goals of the public school system. From the beginning of this century, the schools have been protagonists of social control on the one hand and free cooperation on the other, both placed at the service of the, quote, good society, conceived of as highly organized and smoothly working corporate structure. Under the impact of intense urbanization, children became a natural resource to be molded by the schools and fed into the industrial machine. Progressive politics and the cult of efficiency converged in the growth of the U.S. public school. Vocational guidance and the junior high school were two important results of this kind of thinking. It appears, therefore, that the attempt to produce specified behavioral changes, which can be measured and for which the processor can be held accountable, is just one side of a coin, whose other side is the pacification of the new generation within specially engineered enclaves which will seduce them into the dream world of their elders. These pacified in society are well described by Dewey, who wants us to, quote, make each one of our schools an embryonic community life, active with types of occupations that reflect the life of the larger society, and permeate it with the spirit of art, history, and science. Unquote. In this historical perspective, it would be a grave mistake to interpret the current three-cornered controversy between the school and establishment, the educational technologists and the free schools, as a prelude to a revolution in education. This controversy reflects rather a stage of an attempt to escalate an old dream into fact, and to finally make all valuable learning the result of professional teaching. Most educational alternatives proposed converge toward goals which are imminent in the production of the cooperative man, whose individual needs are met by means of his specialization in the American system. They are oriented towards the improvement of what, for lack of a better phrase, I call the schooled society. Even the seemingly radical critics of the school system are not willing to abandon the idea that they have an obligation to the young, especially to the poor, an obligation to process them, whether by love or by fear, into a society which needs discipline specialization, as much from its producers as from its consumers, and also their full commitment to the ideology which put economic growth first. Dissent veils the contradictions inherent in the very idea of school. The established teachers' unions, the technological wizards, and the education liberation movement reinforce the commitment of the entire society to the fundamental axioms of a schooled world, somewhat in the manner in which many peace and protest movements reinforce the commitments of their members, be they black, female, young or poor, to seek justice through the growth of the gross national income. Some of the tenets, which now go unchallenged, are easy to list. There is, first, the shared belief that behavior which has been acquired in the sight of a pedagogue is of special value to the pupil and of special benefit to society. This is related to the assumption that social man is born only in adolescence, and properly born, only if he matures in the school womb. Some want to gentle by permissiveness, others to stuff with gadgets, and still others to varnish with a liberal tradition. And there is, finally, a shared view of youth, which is psychologically romantic and politically conservative. According to this view, changes in society must be brought about by burdening the young with the responsibility of transforming it, but only after their eventual release from school. It is easy for a society founded on such tenets to build up a sense of its responsibility for the education of the new generation, and this inevitably means that some men may set, specify, and evaluate the personal goals of others. In a passage from an imaginary Chinese encyclopedia, Jorge Luis Borges tries to evoke the sense of giddiness such an attempt can produce. He tells us that animals are divided into the following classes: A. Those belonging to the emperor. B. Those that are embalmed. C. Those that are domesticated. D. The suckling pigs. E. The sirens. F. Fabulous ones. G. The roaming dogs. H. Those included in the present classification. I. Those that drive themselves crazy. J. Innumerable ones. K. Those pointed with a very fine brush of camel hair. L. Etc. M. Those who have just broken the jug. N. Those who resemble flies from afar. Now, such a taxonomy has not come into being unless somebody feels it can serve his purpose. In this case, I suppose, that somebody was a tax collector. For him, at least, this taxonomy of beasts must have made sense, in the same way in which the taxonomy of educational objectives makes sense to specific authors. In The Peasant, the vision of men with such inscrutable logic, empowered to assess his cattle, must have induced a chilling sense of impotence. Students, for analogous reasons, tend to feel paranoiac when they seriously submit to a curriculum. Inevitably, they are even more frightened than my imaginary Chinese peasant, because it is their life goals rather than their livestock which are being branded with an inscrutable sign. And this passage of Borges is fascinating because it evokes the logic of irrational consistency, which makes both Kafka's and Kistler's bureaucracies so sinister, yet so evocative of everyday life. Irrational consistency mesmerizes accomplices who are engaged in mutually expedient and disciplined exploitation. It is the logic generated by bureaucratic behavior, and it becomes the logic of a society which demands that the managers of its educational institutions be held publicly accountable for the behavioral modification they produce in their clients. Students who can be motivated to value the educational packages which their leaders obligate them to consume are comparable to Chinese peasants who can fit their flocks into the tax form provided by Borges. At some time during the last two generations, a commitment to therapy triumphed in American culture, and teachers came to be regarded as therapists whose ministrations all men need if they wish to enjoy the equality and freedom with which, according to the Constitution, they are born. Now the teacher-therapists go on to propose lifelong educational treatment as the next step. The style of this treatment is under discussion. Should it take the form of continued adult classroom attendance, electronic ecstasy, or periodic sensitivity sessions? All educators are ready to conspire to push out the walls of the classroom with the goal of transforming the entire culture into a school. The American controversy over the future of education, behind its rhetoric and noise, is more conservative than the discourse in other areas of public policy. On foreign affairs at least, an organized minority constantly reminds us that the United States must renounce its role as the world's policeman. Radical economists, and now even their less radical teachers, question aggregate growth as a desirable goal. There are lobbies for prevention over cure in medicine, and others in favor of fluidity over speed in transportation. Only in the field of education do the articulate voices demanding radical deschooling of society remain so dispersed. There is a lack of cogent argument and of mature leadership aiming at the disestablishment of any and all institutions which serve the purpose of compulsory learning. For the moment, the radical deschooling of society is still a cause without a party. This is especially surprising in a time of growing, though chaotic, resistance to all forms of institutionally planned instruction on the part of those aged 12 to 17. Educational innovators still assume that educational institutions function like funnels for the programs they package. For my argument, it is irrelevant whether these funnels take the form of a classroom, a TV transmitter, or a liberated zone. It is equally irrelevant whether the packages pervade, are rich or poor, hot or cold, hard or measurable, like Math 3, or impossible to assess, like sensitivity. What counts is that education is assumed to be the result of an institutional process managed by the educator. As long as the relations continue to be those between a supplier and a consumer, educational research will remain a circular process. It will amass scientific evidence in support of the need for more educational packages and for their more deadly accurate delivery to the individual consumer, just as a certain brand of social science can prove the need for the delivery of more military treatment. An educational revolution depends on a twofold inversion: a new orientation for research and new understanding of the educational style of an emerging counterculture. Operational research now seeks to optimize the efficiency of an inherited framework, a framework which is itself never questioned. This framework has the syntactic structure of a funnel for teaching purposes. The syntactic alternative to it is an educational network or web for the autonomous assembly of resources under the personal control of each learner. This alternative structure of an educational institution now lies within the conceptual blind spot of our operational research. If research were to focus on it, this would constitute a true scientific revolution. The blind spot of educational research reflects the cultural bias of a society in which technological growth has been confused with technocratic control. For the technocrat, the value of an environment increases as more contacts between each man and his milieu can be programmed. In this world, the choices which are manageable for the observer or planner converge with the choices possible for the observed so-called beneficiary. Freedom is reduced to a selection among packaged commodities. The emerging counterculture reaffirms the values of semantic content over the efficiency of increased and more rigid syntax. It values the wealth of connotation above the power of syntax to produce wealth. It values the unpredictable outcome of self-chosen personal encounter above the certified quality of professional instruction. This reorientation toward personal surprise rather than institutionally engineered values will be disruptive of the established order until we dissociate the increasing availability of technological tools which facilitate encounter from the increasing control of the technocrat of what happens when people meet. Our present educational institutions are at the service of the teacher's goals. The relational structures we need are those which will enable each man to define himself by learning and by contributing to the learning of others. Now, I would amplify Illich's ambitions there for relational technology and say that the money system we need is a system of gifts, ones that allow people to express their love in whatever way they feel best for them. Now, if that sounds very vague, apologies for not going into it in more detail, but I'm sure Illich would agree that this program is a convivial technology. It brings people together of like spirit and doesn't get in anybody's way if they happen to be of a different mind. As an example, what I mean, one listener emailed me and asked me about September the 11th and said, yep, it's 10th anniversary coming up. I'm going to put a call out. If you have a September the 11th event planned, or if you would like to notify other unwelcome guests listeners, then send me an email. I'm unwelcome@unwelcomeguests.net. I'm planning to launch Wikipedia Plus. If you would like to help me with that, it's a simple matter of going through a lot of Wikipedia pages, saying which particular pages match which particular episode of Unwelcome Guests, or which category on the Unwelcome Guests website. So you don't need any programming skills to take part. You just need an ability to work your way through some Wikipedia pages. If you're interested in helping with that, again, email me unwelcome@unwelcomeguests.net. Now, we've just got time for a little bit of Gatto. We're not going to finish it. I thought we would, but we haven't got long this week. So here is Gatto on what the school system has done to most people's minds.
Would you like to talk about group elasticity?
Oh, well, we're talking there about a structural engineering term. If you want to protect your tall building against high winds, you want the building to be elastic so that it can, like the Statue of Liberty or the Empire State Building in New York. I'm dating myself, I know, there are lots of tall ones, but you know, it can sway 35 or 40 feet off its center, and its elasticity brings it back to the vertical again. When a building like that is about to collapse, what you see is plastic behavior. Once again, I'm borrowing these terms from structural engineering. That you see the thing go off, it's true, but it doesn't return. It doesn't collapse either. It comes partway back. And then the next titanic gust of wind, it goes farther. And eventually, this plastic behavior leads it to a collapse. There's a famous film that I believe is on YouTube, too. I took some courses in structural engineering. It's a bridge out in the state of Washington, across wherever Washington breaks at the top into water and then continues again. That bridge in 1940 was photographed first in elastic behavior, recovering each time, and then you can see it. Fascinating, in slow motion, losing its snapback and gradually just collapsing. Well, the intelligent, the educated mind displays elastic behavior, and it deals with emergencies and returns to true as soon as it can. But the rigidly trained mind, which, and I beat on the radio talk shows yesterday, so let me beat on them again. You can see that they've swallowed a number of precepts that are attractive to their listeners and certainly are partially true, but they've swallowed them religiously, and their entire presentation depends on being able to return to terms like free market, etc. As external circumstances deviate so far from what these precepts were formulated to describe, that the precepts no longer work, such as the term free market. It is a wonderful thing, but it's an imaginary goal to work toward. I guess in little farm markets in the mountains of South America, you may have true free markets. Maybe in isolated corners of the United States, locally, you have true free markets. But the national markets and the international markets are rigged beyond belief. You know, the rewards are distributed to the people who are supposed to get the rewards because they stabilize the society, the type of government, you know, they provide the work that prevents revolution. And so you see in military contracting all the time. I mean, the military buys tons of stuff that never get used. It's just an easy justification to root part of the national treasure into the hands that are supposed to have it. Oh, good grief.
Well, that may not raise too many eyebrows for regular unwelcome guest listeners, but I thought I'd amplify it since I had a short clip about the cost of air conditioning tents and other structures in Iraq and Afghanistan. And this is from July the 28th, 2010.
The term we were looking for is Forward Operating Base, or FOB. The U.S. has many FOBs in Iraq and Afghanistan. The large ones have many tents and other structures where personnel live and work, and all of them need to be heated in the winter and cooled in the summer. That can take a lot of fuel. Steve Anderson is a retired brigadier general who is General David Petraeus' chief logistician in Iraq. He says the Pentagon should find ways to make structures at FOBs and other military compounds more energy efficient, not only to save money and be greener, but also to save lives.
What's happening out there, the reason that lives are being lost is because they got kids out there that are driving escorts or actually driving fuel trucks, moving fuel, and they're getting killed by IEDs. You got these huge 40,000-pound fuel trucks rolling down the road. Those are very, very enticing targets to our enemies. And at least 1,000 Americans have been killed moving fuel. And in essence, what we're doing is we're air conditioning the desert over there in Iraq, Afghanistan, and other places. DOD will spend about $20 billion annually to air condition tents and temporary structures in Iraq and Afghanistan. So obviously, anywhere where you can achieve even a modest improvement in efficiency, you're talking about billions of dollars. And it's not hard to do this. You spray closed cell spray polyurethane foam on the exterior of the tent.
Now, practically, I think I've used some of this spray insulation in the attic of my house, and it's basically you just spray it on a surface and it sticks and gets to be, you know, expands like a foot deep. Is that the kind of stuff you're suggesting spraying on the tents?
Yeah, absolutely. The Army has already demonstrated its ability to do that. I was the senior logistician in 2007 that came up with this technique. I briefed personally General Petraeus on this issue. We executed a $95 million contract in April of 2007, and that $95 million contract to insulate tents is producing $1 billion in annual cost avoidance and taking 10,000 trucks off the road. And that's just not my numbers. This is an official study that was executed by the Army's Army Materials Systems Analysis Agency called AMSA, and they confirmed those numbers. Now, my issue is this. Why don't we now have official policy requiring us to use those kind of initiatives? I mean, although it seems like a lot of billion dollars, it's just scratching the surface. The infrastructure that we have in Iraq and Afghanistan is incredibly inefficient. And I'm just saying, do simple things like use closed cell spray polyurethane foam or use energy efficient structures from the very beginning, and you'd save billions.
So why is this not official DOD policy right now?
It's a good question. I just retired in November. You know, I know that I personally briefed senior leadership in the Army. Everybody nods their heads and says it's a good thing to do. But I believe that there's a lack of commitment to this because they think that they're going to be tying the operational commander's hands. They're empowering an operational commander. They're taking trucks off his road by requiring this policy.
That is the voice of retired Brigadier General Anderson, former chief logistician to General David Petraeus in Iraq, whose brilliant idea, why don't we insulate the tents before we air condition them, is apparently saving $1 billion a year. Now, I don't know how much advanced study he did in the area of military logistics, and I don't want to decry the man's obvious genius, not only for coming up with that idea, but for getting people to take it seriously. But I do think, actually, simple common sense could have driven one to the same conclusion. Now, it might also have provided an answer, which I notice he didn't, to the question, well, why isn't this ordinarily done? Am I being too cynical to suspect that certain influential powers that be earn a few cents on every dollar which is spent in the military campaign, and thus saving $1 billion a year is a multi-million dollar loss for those guys? I think anybody who's read Catch-22 will probably form the same conclusion. I mean, what he came up with is a win all round. So how did that become somebody's loss? Ah, well, that would be the money system. Notice that. The money system inevitably pits people against one another because there's this imaginary scarce resource, money, and whenever it changes hands, somebody is buying, somebody is selling, and a reduction in the outgoings for one organization is a reduction in the income for another one. It sounds like complete common sense, but it's only common sense from within the money system. If you can imagine a world without money, an efficiency saving like that is a win all round. And this is my stock answer to people who talk about the crisis of population. Is there really too many people, or is it just that everybody's fighting each other, that people are told you are a consumer, you're a drain on the world's resources? If people believe that, then yeah, the more people, the worse for the planet. It's not easy to get a handle on millions and billions. So looking at Wikipedia, that tells me that something like 200 million pounds worth of damage was done by rioters in the UK over 5 days. Well, that rate, 40 million pounds worth per day, is approximately equal to the rate at which the US is spending money on air conditioning its tents and its forward operating bases. So notice how much coverage you've had, how much debates picking apart who are these crazy loony rioters, as opposed to how much coverage you had of the fact that the US was spending billions of dollars a year air conditioning the desert. The more I think about this, the more I become convinced that there's no solution within the existing structures of laws and money, and if we're going to come through this, the only way is to completely reconceive the world, looking not at abstractions and ideological hierarchies, but at the real world. This and all previous episodes of the show are available for download from our MP3 archive, which is unwelcomeguests.net/archive. Music is by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening. Keep giving all you can.